Scott started his business over 20 years ago and is at the forefront of how you can use AI to also get better outcomes, both from a land development and then potentially in the future from a structural point of view. He has a fantastic team and they're continuing to grow. Let's jump on in for this very interesting insights. Thanks, Scott, for joining us on the Industry Leaders podcast today. So we'll go through a little bit of your history, but you're the Managing Director of Inertia Engineering. So firstly, maybe start off with telling us a little bit about Inertia and who you help and where you operate.
Yeah, so we're primarily Southeast Queensland or Brisbane-based firm, civil, structural and flood engineering. Been for just over 20 years now in sort of different forms. We weren't always called Inertia. In fact, we started off as a little firm called Queensland Structural Engineering and changed around 15 years ago to Inertia now. People think the term inertia is quite funny as well because they think it's inert, but the real form of inertia is, I guess you can't change our momentum. So we like to play on the fact that our service had this momentum to it, and particularly with reference to structural design, our buildings stood the test of time as well. So
yeah,
that's sort of the history there. 70 people. Brisbane-based. We work in all sorts of sectors, mostly in the built environment space, from land subdivisional work, industrial projects, housing, community housing, commercial, health, education, everything that's got a building or will have a building on it, essentially is us, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got a wide brand too. And you said you're also expanding into the other states like Victoria, and I'm assuming New South Wales would also potentially be.
That's right. As well. Yeah, so yeah, recently put on our first Victorian lead. That focuses on the land sector primarily down there because we've got some market-leading technology in that space that we think does give us a huge point of difference. So leveraging that and offering value to our clients in that space.
Yeah, brilliant. And we'll go into that exciting stuff, and that's why we've got you on the podcast as well. So tell us kind of a little bit about your journey as well, sort of where you've started and how you got to and then starting the company.
Yeah, so I did civil engineering at UQ, University of Queensland in Brisbane. I actually started as a structural engineer in a small, mid-sized Brisbane firm. Did that for about 6 years, met my founding business partner at that firm. After 6 years, I decided it was time to go overseas, like a lot of Australians do. Spent 3 years over there. During that 3 years, I said I wasn't going to do engineering again, actually. I'd made the decision that I'm probably not the one that likes the real technical side of it. I do like problem solving, without a doubt, but yeah. I don't necessarily like day-to-day technical side of it. I like the people.
So what did you think you were going to do when you came back, or what did you want to go and pursue instead?
Well, I actually, for a year, I got into marketing, sales, marketing, finance and construction for project homes. So I got to do some really exciting things through that period, including, you know, helping organize TV commercials and having people, celebrities as part of that as well. So that was good fun.
And I think that's the thing, actually, and you and I had this conversation a few years ago, that, yeah, starting a business is there's the technical part, but then there's actually the business side as well. And I think, you know, I recently did a reflection on if I went back in my 20s, what would I tell myself to do? And that would be, honestly, marketing and sales side of things, because if you get that part of it right, you can have the best services in the world, but unless you know how to articulate that and do that, it's never going to actually, you know, be able to lead through. You still got to deliver on it.
Yes. Right.
So you're going to have the ability to do it, but it's a very, very important skill, I think, that a lot of technical people don't necessarily understand, that they sometimes see BD or sales as something negative when actually it's about finding the right people and finding the people you can help.
Well, that's right. And if you feel good about helping on a project or for a client, why not tell other people about that, and why wouldn't you want to do it for more projects and more clients? So my classical saying that people probably get sick of hearing from me is doing a good job's only half the battle. you know, you've got to tell people about it a little bit too. So
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's one of those skills as well. So I looked at that and I was quite interested in that as well. And I'm assuming that then gave you a really interesting insight into the world of development as well and land development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I actually, that's right. And I've done a few projects as well in that space. So I got to learn pretty much everything from start to finish on a project, which obviously isn't something that engineers get exposed to, from acquisitions of land to design to marketing to financing as well. Financing both at the development side of financing and also the commercial side. If you're selling a block of land or a house and land package, how to help an individual obtain finance for that. So it was all spectrums. But particularly for me, the more exciting bit was the sales and marketing side. I was always drawn to that. Yeah.
And so then what made you sort of think I'm going to go and start my own thing?
Well, what happened was the GFC, and it sort of fell in a little bit of a hole over GFC, like a lot of things did at that time. And I was about to get married, so I thought I better get a real job again. And we joined up with my current business partner. And yes, I suppose the rest is history, really.
And here you are. Well, I mean, that's the thing. Well done. You know, it's always one, starting a company and keeping it and growing it to the size and doing what you're doing. So it's never a small feat. I think it's always a lot harder to start something than take over something. But at the same time, you make a lot of learnings within that. And I think, Nersha, tell us a little bit about your sort of culture and your values and how you make sure you're bringing, you know, what has been between your founder, co-founder and yourself into actually, you know, making sure the business continues on in that way?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good question, because you do get a lot of businesses that change. And businesses have to adapt as they grow, but you see particularly larger businesses, they struggle a little bit with maintaining culture. And it's been a real focus for us. And I suppose culture for us generally means not being too serious, bringing some personality to the business, giving back as well. We're very strong in fundraising and giving back to community, having a lot of fun along the way, being very connected to each other, to your teammates, because that's where, whether it's our teammates or even to the broader industry, that's where the most fun has happened, by doing a great job but having fun doing it. And generally, if you're having fun doing it, you'll actually be more committed to it anyway, which means you'll actually end up doing a better job. So it's all fairly circular.
Well, I think the other side is that people come to you for technical, but, you know, projects are about building things together and working together. And so there's having fun in what you're doing, but there's also, you know, obviously you've got internal project teams, but you've got external project teams too. So having that, you know, jovial, or I suppose that not taking yourselves too seriously but working together approach is always going to have a better outcome than we're right or we have to win.
Yeah, and you know it when you've achieved that sort of connection between an internal or external, particularly external project team, when people can start questioning each other or even having a dig every now and then without anyone getting offended, and people just going, yeah, that's fair, I'll take that on board or look at something. And like you say, best results come from that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's talk about some of the really exciting things. One, obviously, you've got a piece of AI software. So I'd really like to talk to you about what you saw as the opportunity there, what you're seeing as well, and then open that up to where we sort of see that might continue to progress in the future.
Yeah, I suppose firstly, you know, with the sort of advent of AI and really AI is probably a little bit overused, because half the time people are saying AI and it's actually automation. But you know, I think it's brought a real focus on what businesses can do and should be doing. But my mindset has always been, it's coming whether you like it or not. Stop, don't put your head in the sand and ignore it. Work out what you can do with it and what you can achieve. Because if you don't have that mindset, you will be left behind. I have no doubt that there's businesses now, they're going to go through a blockbuster or a Kodak moment where they, you know, they just get left behind because they think they're really, really great now, but things are changing, yeah. and if they stick their head in the sand, they'll struggle. I don't know who they are. I'm not naming anyone.
Always that early adopters versus, you know, those who come sort of late to the party. It doesn't mean that people won't, but in essence, it's coming. So embrace where this is going, understand what it is doing, what the capabilities are. How can this help us to achieve better outcomes for what we do? I'm assuming that's sort of where your mindset was.
Exactly. So, you know, how can we improve our service? You know, so that's ultimately why we exist, is to service our customers, clients, and achieve an outcome for them. So how can we improve that? Everything else looks after itself then. So I guess that's our open mindset as a background to that. And this opportunity came to us through a very random reach out. Nick, the director from this particular software we're going to talk about, the director from Civix, who is our partners in this venture, he reached out via email as he was trying to look partnered with a consultancy in Australia, and one of the ones that he reached out to. Ultimately, we hit it off really well. We had a very similar mindset and approach to business, got along well, didn't take ourselves too seriously, and could see the opportunity of doing something together in this space. So specifically, it's a piece of software developed for essentially complex earthworks sites. There is another piece of the software that's coming that'll be more in the service pipe side of things, but this is complex earthwork sites and primarily around residential land subdivision, where essentially it automates the grading and earthworks design with an AI overlay to review what the automation does. And that's the real power in it. The AI checks to make sure it's compliant with the rules you give it. It checks to make sure, or it directs the automation to give you a result that you're trying to aim for, to optimize that design.
And what value is this providing to developers?
Yeah, so it's fun. I actually say to a few people, it's really great to have a conversation with our clients about it, or our prospective clients about it, when I know that we can add so much value. So at all phases, essentially what I'd boil it down to is it does things so much faster. And when we're talking about an example of a, say, 500-lot subdivision, doing the earthworks design for that in a traditional way might be somewhere between 8 to 10 weeks. We're doing it in 2 weeks.
Yeah, right.
On top of that, then, because we've got that speed, we can run options concurrently, therefore testing different alternative layouts for them so that they have a real confidence going forward about which to choose that's going to give them the best outcome. Ultimate. So we can do that at due diligence phase. We can do that at planning phase, in detailed design, because we can do so much, it's so much faster. We can get it into council faster, reduces their holding costs. We can get it back into council if there's an RFI faster. The sort of savings we're finding around just on optimization of earthworks are somewhere around $5,000 to $7,500 per lot. And the sort of savings we're finding in time is a couple of months, which can be hundreds of thousands of dollars of holding costs for them. Some of them,
absolutely.
Some of them say, I don't care what you charge. Well, I mean, they do care what we charge, but they say, you know, like, really, you're saving so much time and money that.
Absolutely. And also the ability to run so many options. I think that's one of the things that AI enables, as we had a bit of a pre-chat, you know, people firstly go into that comment of yours. AI, I agree with you. I see things where it's all thrown AI. I'm just like, that wasn't AI 12 months ago, but now everybody's on the AI bandwagon.
Yep.
But there is a point of there's automation, which is doing, and it depends, again, which software you're using, what processes you're doing to set it up. But then there is the ability to run multiple scenarios over at once and be able to show multiple different ways of doing things. And that's what AI can do a lot faster than a human brain, is to be able to just run those calculations and those options multiple times. But you're not outsourcing it to the AI. It is, at the end of the day, it's still a tool for a professional who knows what they're doing to run that in as well. And I'm assuming that you guys have been building that. And as you said initially, you've also, you keep reiterating and it learns faster, but you still need somebody who's in control and knows what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a very technical version of asking Google search the wrong thing. Or not specifying, you know, in detail what you want and getting general answers. So,
yeah,
that's how I'd explain it at a high level. But at a nitty gritty level, this software is certainly not going to be used anytime soon, and probably never going to be used by a non engineering mind, because you probably potentially go round and round in circles. You might get the result you want, but often we have to really analyze what we're getting out, making sure we're putting in the right thing. Obviously, as you know, with AI and any automation, that's the most important thing first. But then if it can't achieve what you've asked it to, you've got to then direct it how to go next. And so we might do a run of a site that gives us then an output that essentially gives us a heat map of where its errors are to an extent, or errors or what it can't achieve to comply with the requirements you've asked it. And then we've got to go, well, why it can't it? So then we've got to put the engineering hats on, stand back and look at it and going, oh, what things could we fix or change to allow that to occur? And that's been our biggest lesson probably over the last particularly 6 months. We've improved a lot in our own efficiency of getting the right result faster. So what used to take us maybe 10 runs now takes us 3 runs. To get that really great result.
Yeah, you know what the components are, you know what you're looking for, you know which, how to prompt it and to get it to do things. Now, we talked about this as well, obviously, in running a piece of technical AI software like that, you know, we obviously, most people are using LLMs these days for their AI, you know, things like ChatGPT, Claude, other pieces. So they're kind of getting a little bit of an idea, but at the same time, as we talked about, there is a mindset and approach. What are you sort of finding in the difference of this is a new tool, in essence? What are you sort of finding from within people's approach or how they're doing it for some people who are understanding it and able to implement it quickly versus some people who might find it more challenging?
Yeah. Look, our team, we probably have mostly very open, or we do have mostly a very open open-minded people in our team. It sort of goes with our culture. So internally, some people are faster at taking it up than others. Some people realize how good it can be in one day. Some people do it in 3 months, but everyone gets to that point. What I think, and this is what I explained, I guess, when we first brought it into our businesses, all the things that you do, generally speaking, the boring things, and the stuff that you don't have to do anymore. So you don't have to go through a site and grade step by step by step by step. And then you realize that you made one mistake and you've got to sort of start again. Or the client asks for a bit different criteria for your road grade or your retaining wall, and then you really start again. And that's painful. That people don't realize that our engineers and designers doing that work, how much pain that causes, because it's weeks of work sometimes. Instead, they change the criteria, press a button and review what comes out in the end. Then they can think more creatively around how do I get a better layout? How do I change criteria in certain parts of the site to get the best result possible? So time back so that they can use their creative minds, which ultimately is what brings us happiness, using our creativity and solving problems. Particularly engineers.
Yeah, absolutely. But, yeah. And sort of, I mean, I do know engineers love a bit of calculations, but essentially being able to have, you know, I was talking to somebody else the other day, but, you know, it's essentially like using a calculator or Excel, right? It's just running it at multiple speeds and being able to do multiple things. And I think that it is one of those things where people can either view AI as something that they can be scared of, or they can view it like the introduction of a new software system that can just run it at multiple speeds, run more variations to be able to do that. But again, as we've talked about, it does also take people to have that mindset. And it's the skill. At the end of the day, it's like running any piece of software. You kind of have to learn the fundamentals of it and how it's operating to be able to do that as well. And it sounds like, as you said, you know, you're forward thinking and open to things and trying things out. And so that will no doubt emulate into the organization as well. Mm. You know, you're not a big behemoth either. You know, you've got that ability to really customize and work with people and have smaller teams. And so no doubt that's where I see AI has an ability to also create quite a competitive advantage to SMEs over big companies where they have to go, you know, a lot of your competitors, massive internationals, right? And just the layers to even get things in can actually speed that down. So I'm very interested over the next sort of 5 years, how we're going to see the emergence of smaller to medium-sized firms who are really able to provide really better outcomes for clients because they can move faster, because they can use technology to be able to enable them to do a lot more with a lot less and a lot faster.
Yeah, it is potentially very disruptive in the sense that you could do more as a small firm and seem like a big firm than what you could before. I think there's probably just over small to lower mid is the sweet spot, and I'm probably a bit biased saying that given that we're in that space.
I don't know if I call you small, but smaller engineers have a different criteria to...
Well, you need enough time and money to invest in innovation, and it does take time. And
yeah,
and you know, our partners that develop this software, it's a 9-year journey. When he was small and doing it essentially by himself, the first 5 years would have been bits and pieces. But at our size now, we can invest in further development software. But like you say, we're not too big to be too difficult to change. So I think there's a sweet spot.
And I think at the end of the day, it's just the clients that benefit, yes, right, as well. And that's obviously who we're doing. How we do the work will continue to evolve and change. You know, it's just like including, you know, the CAD software. You know, some people are using CAD, some people are using Revit. It's like, yep, it's just a tool. At the end of that, it's just a tool of the trade. You still need to have the technical abilities to be able to understand what you're doing and what actually needs to be built. I mean, that's probably one of my questions is obviously sort of moving to the next part of where we sort of see that development within skills and the nature of what people, you know, are going to be doing and how work might look, particularly in this industry in the next 10 to 20 years and the evolution of skills and mindset that people need to have?
I think there's quite a few things. I do believe that, you know, the technology advances, particularly AI and automation, will probably skip out a lot of low to mid roles being on. So the important thing is if you're coming out of university now or in the future, how can you understand the fundamental understanding of the industry and the design, whether whatever engineering you're doing or something else? You need to understand the fundamentals first, the first principles. So if you don't give yourself that basis, then you'll really struggle to understand what things are doing and how to direct it. So I think once you've got that, and then understand then how to utilize the software, you're pretty good. But if you skip those, and ironically, it's not ironic at all. It's exactly how it is already. If you don't understand the fundamentals, you're probably limiting yourself. Don't skip those things. And then, as I've said to many people, even before this journey we're on now with this particular piece of software, I remember we had some school students in, 16-year-old girls in our office. I think it was Women in Engineering Day, and we had a discussion to them about skills required in the future. They were all girls that were really, really interested in the engineering, the technical and the math side of things. And I said, what do you think you're going to need? You know, what are you doing now or will you be doing that you won't be doing in the future? And again, it comes back to all those mundane, repeatable, I call it boring. Some people don't, but it's boring things because they're the things that will be automated and used for AI. But the things that it can't really, and there may be some arguments around this, but it can't really replace is communication So the connection with people and the communication, people are always going to want that. So how do you communicate an idea or a design, or as we talked about with marketing, how do you communicate the result that you've got? And creativity. So, you know, our creativity is the thing that really we should be leveraging in managing and directing AI, to be able to step back, see something holistically, think outside the box, and then utilize the software to be able to achieve a result. The exciting thing. And then if you focus on those two skills, I think you do it well.
Well, and I think particularly as a structural engineer, that is, you know, I mean, you know, I've worked with a lot of architects, right? So obviously, you know, your best structural engineers are the ones who can make things possible where those challenges really are, right? Yeah. I think most structural engineers would like a square, you know, tall building. That's good. That makes it easy. But at the same time, it is great. I mean, that's where, you know, you find the best engineers are the ones who are thinking like designers. Can we do? How can we push the limits but make sure the building's not going to fall down? And I think that is it. I think we have all these fantastic tools that will only help us to be able to produce work faster, but that human element isn't going to change how we interconnect. And I think that's one of the things, as you said, learning the fundamentals of your trade, but also learning the fundamentals of how work, who are we actually serving? Who are we actually helping? How are they, what are their pain points? What are they looking to achieve? That's the part where, you know, graduates and mid-levels sitting in, attending meetings, watching that, observing that, understanding the nature of how things work and how we actually get the work done and delivered is fundamental as well.
Yeah, one of our values is curiosity, and that's just saying, ask questions, listen to others, find out what people care about. Your service and your design and whatever you do is better by understanding what everyone else is interested in, what they're focused on.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, brilliant. Now, you know, you are quite open there. You work in, obviously, the Queensland market. There's a lot of excitement and hype around Queensland at the moment. There's been a change in government and things like that. Where do you see the opportunities? We'll stick to Queensland in general to start with. Where do you see the opportunities and the challenges that the market's facing at present?
Yeah, obviously, you know, there's a lot of investment coming into Queensland and it will continue to do so. I'm probably not a subscriber that it's all going to change or stop at the Olympics. I feel that Brisbane and Southeast Queensland in particular will be put on the map from the Olympics, and there'll be future population growth here, whether it's interstate or international. Traditionally, international immigration has gone into Sydney or Melbourne, and then the state comes to Queensland, but I think that might change. But the biggest challenge, and you know, everyone talks about it, so I sort of don't like talking about it because it's everyone knows is that when you're building so many things at once, it costs a lot more. I think the Queensland government's doing the right things around making it a little bit more open in the sense of less restrictive from a labour perspective. There's certainly some firms from New South Wales coming up to help provide competition in that space. But ultimately, we're still limited by the labour pool and the supply to an extent, but particularly the labour pool that we've got here. And I think there needs to be some out-of-the-box thinking, to be honest, in that space.
Well, some people may or may not. You assume everybody knows the Queensland market. But, you know, in essence, there is a lack of trades on the ground. The trades are quite expensive as well. There's not that many, if we're talking in the built form, there's not that many builders capable of building. We've got a limited amount of actually builders who are, you know, still not in liquidation, who can actually take on the risk to actually build buildings, plus obviously then infrastructure costs as well. So, I mean, it is something that we know that it's a lot easier to go and work on, you know, a union site. You know, there was lots of things through the after Queen's Wharf, lots of changes. So that, plus then we obviously don't have anywhere for these people to live, to be able to come and to build as well. And that's why you're in a unique position that you're working both in the built form, but also then in housing and development. Obviously, Queensland also has a lot of zoning as well. Like if you come up here, I live on the Gold Coast. If you get on the train from here to Brisbane, you think that's a heap, but there isn't. Most of it's still zoned within, you know, regional areas. Is that changes you're seeing? And what are sort of changes that you see in the opportunities you think that Queensland does have? Because it's not that there's not a lack of land, but it's obviously an infrastructure to build. We're going to be more like Chile than we are like Melbourne, which is more of a full circle and the radius to any one point is a bit different.
Yeah, the opportunities, I mean, I suppose we certainly have a can-do government. That's probably useful that they appear to be listening to the industry and reacting to that, and they certainly are. Not just appear to be. I've seen that firsthand, the changes in policy very quickly. I've never seen any government move as fast as they have in adopting new policies and implementing things very quickly.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic. I think at a federal level, we probably need a little bit more support in the labor, the people side of things. You know, 2 years ago, they changed some immigration policies and fast-tracked immigration for yoga instructors and dog walkers, but not construction workers. I think we know why they did that, but I think it's backwards, right? Like it's we need houses first. I think that's, yeah. I think in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the housing comes above yoga. So we should probably focus on that first, just below the doctors and whatnot, right? And we've got opportunities there. Like we're calling it, people call it a crisis in housing. Like if it's a crisis, act like it's a crisis. If you have a crisis where like the floods that just happened in North Queensland, you mobilize the army to go and help. If you have a war, you react like it's a war. So even a small example of a large construction site regionally, you get out there, you put a lot of trades out there, you put a workers' camp out there and you build it. So I just don't see everyone talks about a crisis, but no one's really responding like it's a crisis.
Oh, and look, I'm glad you opened that because I think that's one of the things that most people don't realise is that the migration is actually exceptionally important in this. And, you know, we can migrate, you know, like the southerners like me. And yes, it might be because of the Olympics, but I think, you know, if you ever leave in Queensland, you actually realise it is a bloody brilliant place to live.
Yep.
And so, you know, most people who are seeking that sort of lifestyle but still want to keep, you know, a business and a hub. And I really feel like over the last 5 years, Brisbane in itself is becoming, you know, more from that sort of city, country town to really now an established city that's just, you know, it'll continue to change and evolve as well. And I think there's lots of opportunities. The government and the state government, for those who aren't in Queensland, it is, you know, you can probably see that the difference between Queensland and Victoria at the moment. You have a government that is, okay, we need to get this done. We need to get this built. What's stopping that? Let's actually open up. And I think that's why people are quite excited about the Queensland market as well. But at the same time, there's billions of projects sitting in DA just because there's nobody to actually build it or to make the construction costs actually add up to that. So, and that fundamentally is, yes, as you said, the supply side, but fundamentally it is the labour side on the trade side as well. So we can take as much as we want potentially and attract people from other states, but majority of that is probably going to come from overseas. And I know we work with trades, right? And when we advertise trades, we get like 8 people apply. It's like it's the lowest number of applications that we get. And, you know, to headhunt, you know, trades is very different to attract them versus for professionals. So it's a fundamental piece of the puzzle that we all sort of know, which is the problem. But as you said, in essence, this is probably our biggest challenge, but our biggest opportunity is to actually open up those floodgates. Just finish up, is there any other opportunities that you see as well, I suppose, for the next? We've talked about AI and, you know, you're very much leveraging that and the difference in that. We've talked a bit about, you know, Queensland and SEQ. Is there other opportunities that you see, particularly in your field?
Well, I mean, I suppose broadly in the construction field, definitely there's a huge opportunity in our industry in Australia for more modular, more prefab. It's an area that's so underutilized in this country compared to others. And I don't know this for a fact, but my opinion there is that it's underutilized because people don't have the capacity to invest in it. The margins are too low generally in housing. There's other barriers that have been put in place to modular, whether it's imported or local. And I think this is a game where I would see some leadership from the government stand up and sort of co-invest in some areas and act as a real catalyst to drive the industry forward decades at a time. An example is the Queensland and federal government co-invested in quantum computing with Sci Quantum to build a facility in Queensland. You know, and I don't think it's the wrong thing to do. I think it's fantastic because essentially we as taxpayers are then sort of shareholders in that business, and if it works, it changes across the world. Now, why can't we do that in modular construction as well?
Yeah, so it's construction technology. We have a long way to go. I mean, a lot of people who come here go, oh, you build like that. Okay, that's a bit different to how we do it overseas.
Yep.
So modular is one of them, and definitely sort of just looking at different ways that we can build. What do you think is, you've sort of mentioned that with the modular is being open. Is that also because most of it may need to be made overseas, or is it a manufacturing that we can do here, or is it a design, or people under fundamentally understanding how quickly these things can actually be put up and how structurally sound they are?
Yeah, it's interesting because the you get the economics of them and they still don't always stack up. It certainly do regionally, but not necessarily in metro areas. And, you know, I think that's probably a scale thing to an extent. You need some scale to make modular. You definitely need scale to make modular work. And, you know, we need to build a lot more and have that efficiency in the construction.
Yeah, okay.
It probably somewhat comes down to a labor thing again. You know, they still need labor in these places, although obviously generally it's under roof, so you can work hours a day if you wanted to, but you can work through to develop this stuff. But, yes, I'm not an expert on it, but...
interesting, because obviously modular is thrown around a lot, but everybody understanding what the challenges are with that. Excellent, Scott. Thank you so much for all your time. Now, at the end, and we always ask people, is there a book, a podcast, or something else that you would recommend that would be great for listeners to check out as well?
I like a book that I read probably 10 years ago now. I always come back to this one. It's a book by a guy called Daniel Pink called Drive. So it speaks to how people have been motivated through the ages, through different eras. So
great.
Originally being very much motivated by survival to the Industrial Revolution of being motivated by having things, you know, we could finally have things, to now being having different motivations around purpose. And so I really liked it.
I love it. I'll be definitely adding that to the Audible list as well. Thank you very much, Scott, for all of your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure.